We walked up to the iron fence surrounding this mighty stump of an oak with only a few green branches on it and stood there in silence. Yuri tried to feel the vibes from the oak, but nothing happened. Then he said to me, "I know what we must do. We will ask if Spectra visited Abraham here 4,000 years ago, just yes or no. Let's go up on that hill away from these people." We went up the hill and we got out of our car. Yuri asked me for my Universal Geneve watch, and I handed it to him. He then said, "Believe me, this is very sacred. I have never done this before. I am going to turn your watch face up to the sky. We will all look at the face of the watch. Andrea, you ask the question like I told you, then we will see what happens to the watch. If nothing happens, the answer is no. If something happens, the answer is yes." The four of us stared at the watch. I asked the question, "Did you, Spectra, appear to Abraham here?" At one moment as we stared at the watch it read 4:06 p.m. In the next moment it read 4:35 p.m. The hands has moved forward 29 minutes. Yuri was very solemn. "I finally believe that what we are doing today has been going on for thousands of years. It is an old story." We all breathed a quiet amen. As we got in the car and drove on, we all agreed on one point. The hands of my watch had not moved in the usual sense. We had the impression that they had vanished from the first position and reappeared in the second position. Yuri was now sure that this was the process. I recount this incident in some detail because it was the prelude to my own experience with the war problem for the coming 6 days. But I must confess that I did not know it as it happened. I see the pattern only now in hindsight. We drove north past Bethlehem, past Jerusalem, and then west toward Tel Aviv. As we approached the town of Ramla, with the setting sun ahead, we saw the clear outline of a disc-shaped craft in the sky with a red light on the top. It was too far away to see any detail. It did not move. It just winked out about 5 minutes later. As the light of the craft winked out, the headlights on our car also went out. I pulled over to the shoulder just to watch if the craft would reappear. In a minute, the car headlights went on by themselves. We drove on for 5 minutes, and then the engine was mysteriously cut off. No one panicked. We all knew it was they making us aware of their presence. Now, this was the first time that Shippy had been with Uri and me when unusual physical things were happening. I was quite impressed with how naturally Hannah and Shippy accepted these signs. Yuri calmly explained to them in Hebrew what was going on and said we would always be together to do this kind of work. The engine started in 5 minutes. I dropped Hannah and Shippy off at their home in Givatayim about 7 p.m. and Uri at his apartment shortly thereafter. I drove at 100 km/h speed to the Sharon Hotel. My car now worked perfectly. I had just finished taking a bath at 7:45 p.m. when my phone rang. It was Yuri. He sounded awestruck as though he had just seen the angel of Abraham. "Andrea, listen to what happened. At about 7:40 p.m. I went into my small bedroom to turn on the electric heater. My bed was empty of anything. I went out and closed the door so that the room would heat up. Then I went to the bathroom to take a shower. I entered my bedroom at 7:45 p.m., and there upon my bed was a black leather camera case labeled with printed letters Braun ISO. I have never seen such a case before. I asked my mother what she knew, and she said she was in a chair in the living room all the time. Andrea, could this be the camera case you talked about today while we were at the Dead Sea?" I asked him to identify certain marks in the interior of the case, which I had once made. He verified that they were there. I said, "Yuri, that fits the description of the camera case I put in a locked closet in Ossining, New York, on November 17, 1971, which is over 6,000 miles away. How did it get here?" "I don't know," he said. "Are you playing a joke on me?" "I wouldn't play such a joke." "Bring it over tonight when you come here after your show," I said. After this call I began to get ready for the evening session with Uri. I synchronized my wristwatch and an electric digital clock to the radio at 8 p.m. Then I tested my tape recorder for the evening's work. At 8:57 p.m. by the electric clock, I happened to glance at my wristwatch. It had stopped at precisely 8:45:45. Remembering my instructions, I prayed for peace to enter Sadat's heart. I glanced at the watch from time to time. At 10:07 p.m. by the electric clock, exactly, I happened to be looking at my wristwatch and saw the small second hand starting to move. The watch had stopped for 82 minutes. I realized that I was abnormally drained of energy from the effort of praying. That evening when he came to see me, Yuri handed me the black leather camera bag. I inspected it carefully. There was no question about it, it was my own bag which I had left some 6,000 miles away. The only possible conventional explanation was that somebody was playing a trick on us. For example, the Israeli army might conceivably have obtained the camera bag by normal means from Ossining and then planted it on Uri. Yuri told me there were no windows in his bedroom, and there was only one door from the bedroom into the living room. His mother was sitting near this door all the time Uri was in the bedroom. Yuri assured me that his mother was not in collusion with anyone. We felt certain then that this camera bag was translocated by means and agencies unknown. We went ahead with preparations to keep our rendezvous at 11:20 p.m. This time Uri went into hypnotic trance easily and began to speak, "Andrea, I am in a flat place. Noises." Then a powerful resonant voice sounded in the room, "Listen, listen, Andrea. Present more important thing. We have shown you personally, without Uri, how we contact you through your watch. When it stops, pray. Put your movie camera in its original case. We sent it over. Pray peace." There were many other things said during this session which I am not yet permitted to reveal. The session ended at 11:30 p.m. December 20, 1971. Now, my watch had been stopped at 10:45:45 p.m. and had remained stopped until 12:11 a.m. December 21, when Uri had placed his hand over it, and it started running again. The watch was now 90 minutes behind the electric clock. As I was writing up the notes of the session, before the tape vanished, I noticed at 1:32 a.m. electric clock time, that my watch had stopped again at 11:45:45 p.m. This time it remained stopped for exactly 12 hours. It self-started at 11:45 a.m. on December 21. During those 12 hours I sat on my balcony praying for peace as I faced Egypt. This was an ordeal I was not prepared for. I am sure that I must have dozed off at times during this vigil. I realize that it may be tedious for the reader to follow all the details of the various times when the watch stopped. However, to my knowledge, this phenomenon has never before been reported on Earth, and however boring it may be, a full historical account is warranted, which will be found in Appendix 3. After the watch started up at 11:45 a.m. on December 21, I had to go to see Reuven on business. I told him what was happening with my watch. And since 12:45 p.m. was approaching, we both looked at my watch while the hands reached this critical angle. I saw the watch stop, of its own accord, at exactly 12:45 p.m., and pointed it out to Reuven as it happened. I then called Uri from Reuven's apartment, and he told me the following story. A few minutes earlier, at 12:20 p.m. to be exact, Uri had walked into his bedroom and there, at the foot of his bed, was a large, 3 feet by 2 feet, brown suitcase. He inspected it, read the brand label, Tapelite, opened it, and found it to be empty. Then it vanished in front of his eyes. The entire episode lasted about 3 minutes. I left Reuven to go to see Yuri. As Christmas Eve approached, my thoughts turned more and more to the Prince of Peace, and as the 0 hour for possible war approached, I knew that I would have to pray longer and harder. What better place, I thought, than to go to Bethlehem where Jesus was born. As I prayed during the night and on the morning of December 24, I must have nodded off to sleep at one point because I was awakened at 8:18 a.m. I showered, shaved, ate breakfast, and got in my car to go to Bethlehem. This was one day when I really wished to be alone, just to be able to continue my prayer for peace. It was a beautiful sunny day, this December 24, in the Holy Land. One could never guess by looking at the countryside that within a few days this could be the site of the start of a global holocaust. As I drove through Ramla, a largely Arab town, it was obvious that it was the Muslim holy day. Tonight at sundown it would be the Jewish holy day, Shabbat. And Saturday, December 25th, was the Christian holy day of Jesus' birth. For me, brought up in the slums of Chicago in the Catholic faith, it was a profound experience to be here on the road to life, and perhaps mankind's life. I chose the back roads to Bethlehem which wound through the ancient hills of Judah. When I left Beit Shemesh, I got on winding gravel back roads of the Hala Valley, feeling as if I had slipped back several thousands of years into time. As I passed through the Arab villages of El Qadda and Beit Jala, I could see that there were more and more Israeli soldiers and military police. At the edge of Bethlehem I was stopped and told that no cars were allowed beyond this point. So I parked my car where I could and walked over to where the soldiers stood. They said that no one was permitted to enter the inner area of Bethlehem without a pass. The pass had to be applied for a week in advance in order that a security check could be done. There were no exceptions, because the authorities feared an incident by one of the extremist organizations. I was determined to get to the Grotto of the Nativity. I had to complete my prayers. Yet I knew how tough Israeli security was. So I prayed as I walked toward the inspection barrier. A young lady sable lieutenant sternly asked me, in perfect English, for my pass. I said, "Lieutenant, I come in peace from a far-off land. I did not have time to apply for a pass. Look at me, I am honest, open, and have only love for man. Please, Lieutenant, let me pass that I may pray for the peace of the world." I don't know what this officer thought of my plea. But she inspected my passport, gave me a searching look, and stamped a pass, which she handed to me. I thanked her openly, blessed her in my heart, and made my way into Manger Square. I also thanked my friends on high. Although the crowds were large, I was able to enter into the depths of the Grotto of the Nativity and pray on my knees at the very spot where legend has it that Jesus was born. Somehow in the presence of the vast throngs my prayers seemed to gain in meaning and in power. By 3:30 p.m. I felt I had completed my mission to Bethlehem. I moved on to the old city of Jerusalem. As sundown approached, and Shabbat neared, the shops started closing and the streets emptied. By sundown the old city was quite deserted, and I walked its quiet streets alone. It was hard to believe that the very pavements I walked on had once been known by David, his paramour Bathsheba, and their son, the glorious Solomon. This was the city holy to the Muslims, the Jews, and the Christians. I walked over to the Mosque of Omar, built over the dome of the rock where Muhammad had ascended directly to heaven on his white horse. Under this platform surrounding the mosque was the ruin of the Temple of Solomon. I looked at the watch on my left wrist. The Geneva was still stopped at 11:45 and 45 seconds. As a reference standard I had another watch, the Certina on my right wrist that told me that the local time was 5 p.m. The time on the Geneva portended the approach of the crisis as it had now been stopped for over 18 hours. I walked back to my car, which was near the Joppa Gate. I don't know how it happened, but I missed the road to Tel Aviv, and instead made the circumferential drive going north around the old city. I came back to my starting point up the valley of Kidron along the Jericho Road. Passing through the small Arab villages along this valley, I was once again transported to biblical times. The sun had already gone down, Shabbat had begun. The roads were empty as I headed for Tel Aviv. My heart was full of prayer for the knowledge of the richness of life. As I crossed the Israel Road, Sadi Yisrael, I saw ahead on the deserted road a small figure dressed in white, hitchhiking. I stopped and saw that it was a girl. I asked her where she was going after sundown. She smiled and said, "Tel Aviv," and that sundown was not important to her. Her English was excellent, and she spoke freely. Her name was Miriam L., which translates into English as Miriam of God. I asked her what the name Miriam meant in Hebrew. She said, "Miriam means strong. Your English name for this is Mary." But did you know that Miriam was the elder sister of Moses and Aaron? I was truly startled by this reply. Why did you tell me about Moses and Aaron now? She shyly replied, Are you Jewish? I said, No, I was brought up as a Catholic, but I do not practice in that faith now. Well, it would help my explanation if you were. But I shall try. You see, in the back streets of Jerusalem there are many quiet discussions going on about the fate of Israel and of the Jewish people. There is an uneasy feeling about the threat of war now. And when this feeling arises, people talk about Moses, who saved us from slavery in Egypt. But more than that, you can hear it being whispered in Jerusalem among the old and the young about a coming war that has another meaning. These people believe that the Bible says to them today that Israel must suffer three major wars. The first was the 56 war, the second was the 67 war, and the third is yet to come. Now, it is not a fear of the third war that they talk about. Can you understand that they dream about a third war with expectations? They feel that Israel must suffer once more and that the conscience of the world must be burned once more in order to remind us all of the promise of God. And do you know what they say this promise is? They say that the Messiah will appear here in Israel. These people believe these things. And I must say, I do, too. As a young Saber, she breathed all the hopes and ideals of her people. As she talked on, in spite of her talk of war, I somehow felt strengthened in my prayers for peace. But the irony of our situation was not lost on me. Here I was, praying for a war not to occur, because of a potential worldwide spread of a new Middle Eastern war. And this sweet young woman was praying for a Messiah to deliver her people, and mankind, and willing to pay the price of war. I met Uri at the Sharon Hotel at midnight. I told him that my watch had been stopped for over 24 hours now and that I was getting tired. This time, he was unable to start the watch again. We both felt that this was an ominous sign. More effort was needed. Perhaps the prayers were not working. Perhaps Sadat was not being reached. Or maybe others in power had a more decisive role than Sadat. In any case, it was not a good omen. Uri and I parted at 1 a.m. It was now December 25, 1971. I went to my old station at the balcony over the sea facing Egypt. Pray for peace. As dawn came, I had some food. At 11 a.m. my watch was still stopped. I went to the bathroom to take a shower. I reached up with my hands to take from around my neck a Star of David on a gold chain given to me by Uri 5 days earlier. I was amazed to find that the star was missing. I searched the room and finally found the Star of David under my pillow. I had not been to bed that night. I also saw that the connecting gold link between the chain and the star was intact. There was no way that the Star of David could have come off the chain, except by the now familiar vanishing process. I felt that it was a good omen, but I wished that the language were clearer. Uri and Iris visited me at my hotel in the afternoon. I had placed the Geneva and the Certina watches on the table side by side. Uri looked at my Geneva and said, It is still stopped. Rather wearily, I said, Yes, for well over 36 hours now. He placed his left hand, fist clenched, over it and said, I am going to try it once more. As he said this, the Geneva started immediately. The local time by the Certina was 2:34 p.m. My watch had been stopped for a total of 40 hours and 4 minutes. Uri and Iris left shortly thereafter. I went to bed and fell into a very deep sleep. I woke up and looked at the clock. It was 1 a.m., the fateful day of December 26. I turned on the radio, listened to the BBC, the Voice of America, etc. There was no news of any significance. I stepped out on my balcony to get a breath of fresh air. The sky was leaden with low clouds. It had rained while I was asleep. Suddenly, at 1:45 a.m., I saw just one flash of the same blue light that Uri, Iris, and I had seen. It was right in front of me, beneath the clouds to the south. I thought that it could not have been more than a few hundred meters away. As I watched, there was a second blue flash. Then a third blue flash, and that was all. It seemed to say to me, Good show, old chum. Go back to sleep, all is well. I did go to sleep, and awoke at 8:55 a.m. I saw that the Geneva watch had changed to 1:45 and 45 seconds, but I did not know when this had happened. In any case, it was stopped. So I went back to my prayer for peace on the balcony. All the rest of this December 26th, I continued to pray. Yuri called me once at 6:30 p.m. to report that he had lost a gold medallion from his neck chain. He said he would come to see me about 8 p.m. Yuri came in at 7:45 p.m. and sat down on the sofa. We both happened to look at the desk at the same time, and there was his gold medallion. It had just appeared on the carpet beneath the desk. We decided to go down to the first floor dining room to have dinner. The maitre d'hotel chose a table for us. As we sat down, Yuri picked up his napkin. There under the napkin was a Mexican 5-peso piece, which I often carried around with me, that had been left in the desk in my 11th floor room. The fact that we had witnessed the vanishing and the appearance of gold and silver that day made a deep impression on me. Then another first occurred. While we were staring at the 5-peso piece, the silver fork in front of Uri bent up 90 degrees. He had not touched it. When Uri tried to put food in his mouth, at 8:35 p.m., it vanished from inside his mouth. After several unsuccessful tries, we finally gave up trying to have dinner and went upstairs to my room. At 9:03 p.m. Certina time, my Geneva watch again stopped at 2:45 and 45 seconds. At 9:34 p.m. Certina time, my Geneva watch did a strange thing. It jumped from 2:45 and 45 seconds to 3:35 instantly, and then it started to tick normally and kept running. This was the last time in 1971 that my Geneva watch was to stop in this extraordinarily precise way. As Yuri was leaving that night, he was like a man who has just realized that he is suddenly no longer a boy. One of his comments was, "Now I really know that it is not me. They are doing all the work. Imagine, they come to all my crummy shows to do the work. I wonder why they bother with all these little people." As midnight approached, I anxiously listened to all the news. The Arab threats continued that Sadat has promised to liquidate the state of Israel before the week is up. There was no sign in all of Israel that an attack on Egypt was at hand. It was a strange night for me. Outside, there was the giant roar of the surf as a Mediterranean storm battered the coast. There was all the drama of thunder, lightning, wind, and rain dashing against the senses. But it was the roar of nature, not the roar of man at war. Sitting in the dark, I was listening to the voice of America and watching the lightning flashes over the sea. Just as the announcer said, it was 2,215 hours Greenwich Mean Time, 12:15 a.m. local, I saw a bright star due south. I jumped up and saw that it was under the clouds. It was not a plane. Twinkling brightly with an array of colors, it hovered over Tel Aviv. The star shone for a minute, then went off. I got my NISO Super 8 camera out and ready should it reappear. Suddenly, there it was again. Then I had an astounding experience. When I pointed the camera with a 56mm lens toward the light, the camera trigger locked. To test this locking effect, I turned the camera away from the light, and the trigger switch worked nominally. I pointed the camera again at the twinkling colored light, and again the camera froze. I did this repeatedly and concluded that my camera was being controlled from that light, which did not want its picture taken. The light repeated this cycle, staying on for a minute and off for a minute, 7 times. I noted in my diary at the time, "I strongly feel that this light appeared, 7 times, to assure me that all is well. Now I feel assured that peace will begin." 12:45 a.m. December 27, 1971. Sharon, Herzliya by the Sea. On December 29, 1971, I read in the Jerusalem Post, "The public announcement of the results of President Sadat's conference this past week, there will be no war." To this day I do not know why President Anwar Sadat reversed his publicly avowed policy. I do not know what restrained the Israeli government from a preemptive attack in the face of Arab war threats. Someday, I am sure, each side will release its own secret documents with respect to what actually happened in December 1971. As for me, The relief was enormous. As for Uri, it was his second great battle test, much more severe than in the battle for Jerusalem. I was sure that a possible world war threat was over on December 27, 1971, and subsequent history will have to confirm this judgment. I was reviewing the final manuscript on October 18, 1973, and as the reader is surely aware, a war broke out between Israel and Egypt and Syria, October 6, 1973, Yom Kippur. Uri Geller and I were preparing to leave the United States for Frankfurt, Germany, when the war broke out. We went ahead to Frankfurt, in order to be closer to Israel should we be needed there. Naturally, Uri and I contacted the extraterrestrial intelligence to find out at the source how this new war was viewed. The judgment was succinct, concerning Israel. The fight and the war will be fought just like an ordinary war. This war had to come, and they shall fight it out alone. You are not needed this time. This war will be marked in Earth as an important war for the human race. I queried the intelligence as to whether this was the war that was being whispered about in the old streets of Jerusalem. The answer was in the affirmative. Without waiting to hear the words of Sadat, I now set about to find out all I could about the intelligence in the sky about whom we still knew so little. Since I have no other name for the intelligence in the sky, I decided at this time to call it IS for short. In the chapter that follows I will relate some of the lessons that come from IS, most of which came through or around Uri. But to avoid repetition and an unmanageable amount of material, I shall cite only those instances where a new lesson was to be learned. Chapter 6, Eye of the Hawk. On December 28, 1971, at 9:07 p.m. Uri called me while I was in the Sharon Hotel dining room having dinner with Ilar Zebo, who had just come to Israel. He seemed in such a state of alarm on the phone that I became deeply worried. He would not say what was wrong but begged me to come to his apartment immediately. I asked him if I could bring Ilar along, and he said that would actually be helpful. We stopped dinner mid-course and took a cab to Uri's apartment. When we walked in, he was alone, dressed in a bathrobe. He looked at us with red eyes. "I can't tell you what happened, but I cried." "Do grown men ever cry?" he pleaded. "Yes, Uri, I have cried when someone I loved died," I said. He asked us to sit down. He fiddled with his hands aimlessly, wanting to talk, yet somehow constrained. Finally, it came out in bits. He had been secretly in love with a woman for the past 5 years. Her situation was such that they could only meet secretly at rare intervals. An hour and a half earlier she had told Uri that she could never see him again. It was torture for Uri to unburden himself of this secret. He said that he had actually placed a revolver to his head to end his life, but something made him put down the weapon and call me instead. I was profoundly shocked at his deep depression and at the thought that he might die violently, as had Arago. "Uri, please show me the gun," I demanded. Uri walked into his bedroom and handed me a revolver in a brown leather case. I looked at the revolver. It was a .38 caliber Rossi loaded with 6 bullets. "Uri, this gun in your hands really disturbs me. Please, may I take it?" I asked. Uri insisted he was all right now. I offered to spend the night at his place, he refused. I invited him to spend the night at my hotel, he refused. But through all this discussion, he refused to part with the gun, insisting that he was all right. Finally, he agreed to go to the house of a friend he trusted, Sarah Bursak. At midnight we walked with Uri some 4 blocks to Sarah's house and left him in her charge. I called Uri the next morning and casually inquired how he was. He said, "Fine, why do you ask in such a serious way?" "Well, I was concerned about what you said last night," I replied. "What do you mean? What did I say?" he asked. "Don't you remember?" I asked in disbelief. "No, only that you and Ilar were here and we walked over to Sarah's house," he said. I realized that Uri was not depressed and that I could talk very frankly to him. I then repeated very briefly what he had said about his secret love and a gun. He was stunned by my words. "Do you mean I said all that?" "Well, I don't remember saying any of it. It is true about the girl, but it couldn't be true about the gun. I haven't had that gun for 2 months. It is at Shippy's house. Please go over and ask him. Now it was my turn to be stunned. Okay, Yuri, let's drop it, I said. I'll come over to see you tonight after dinner. Good, I'll be waiting for you, he said.